top stories, Lebanon's Hezbollah movement condemns as unjust a Saudi-led campaign against the Lebanese minister over his remarks about the war on Yemen. The UN General Assembly Committee adopts an Iranian-drafted resolution that calls on nuclear-armed states to dismantle their nuclear arsenals. Also ahead, Pakistan's foreign minister tells Press TV that his country and Iran have adopted a joint counter-terrorism strategy. Our top story, Lebanese. The resistance movement Hezbollah has condemned a Saudi-led backlash against the Lebanese minister over his remarks critical of the war on Yemen. Hezbollah praised what it called the courageous position of Information Minister George Qardahi in defending the oppressed people of Yemen. The movement said the campaign by Saudi Arabia and its allies against Qardahi is unjust. Qardahi has said the Saudi-led war on Yemen was futile and it's time to end the conflict. He also has said Yemen's Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. Qardahi made those comments in an interview before taking office. The interview was aired earlier this week. Following that, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their respective capitals to protest Qardahi's remarks. Mariam Saleh says the Saudi-led campaign against the Lebanese minister is actually an effort by Riyadh to put pressure on Lebanon's politics.
He did not say something new. However, with the fact that Saudi Arabia does have a clinch to Lebanon and tends to try to put pressure on Lebanese politics, this is something they want to use here as a card in Lebanon, especially with the fact that these statements were made by Mr. Qardahi before he actually took office, and so before he became minister. So this, how did they basically try to find those statements, look for them, and then use them against him, and now against this cabinet, which is was the only hope for the Lebanese to try to get out of the socioeconomic crisis. So that is one thing, and we're seeing this pressure now being basically as a campaign, a political campaign, and pressure against the cabinet trying to force Mr. Qardahi to resign. Now, let me just give you a background about Mr. Qardahi. This was a person who worked for decades in the Saudi satellite channels, and he has very prominent TV shows. And once he spoke and once he became vocal about his support for the resistance in Lebanon after the liberation of 2000, and after the war in 2006, then he was forced to resign from those the big corporations, and he was sacked from his job because he was vocal about people's resistance against occupation. So this is not new with Saudi Arabia.
The UN General Assembly's first committee has adopted an Iranian-drafted resolution calling on nuclear-armed states to dismantle their entire nuclear arsenal. Resolution calls for an end to production of nuclear weapons and requires nuclear-armed states not to transfer such weapons to other countries. It also calls on the Israeli regime to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and allow UN inspectors to access its facilities. The adopted text says non-nuclear states would be given assurances that they would not be attacked or threatened with nuclear weapons. The United States and the Israeli regime were among the countries that voted against the document. Political commentator Amiro Funes says the powerful Israeli lobbies in the U.S. have allowed the regime to avoid being held accountable for its nuclear weapons program.
There's a complete double standard when it comes to Israel. Israel claims to be the victim. Israel claims to be the weaker underdog. And that's part of the Zionist narrative that they have. They view themselves as the underdog, as people who are oppressed. And there's actually a really disgusting concept in Israeli foreign policy called the Samson option, which is this idea that if other powers attack Israel, that Israel has the power and the capability to bomb the whole world and bring the whole world down with it. So there's some really vicious ideology in Israeli foreign policy. And unfortunately, the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, and all these Zionist organizations in Washington, D.C., they run the U.S. empire. They decide who gets criticized and who doesn't. And that's why we haven't seen any criticism of Israel the way we have of Iran.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on the Security Council to force Israel to end its occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights.
Or further delay. In this context, the Security Council must live up to its responsibility and compel the Israeli regime to end the occupation of the Syrian Golan and also stop immediately its aggressions against Syria. Aggressions and destabilizing measures of the Israeli regime constitute flagrant violations of international law and continue to threaten regional and international peace and security. The assassination on October 16th...
Tahrir-Abouanchi added, all occupying and uninvited foreign forces should leave Syria without any precondition or further delay. Iranian envoy also spoke about what he described as the dire humanitarian situation in Syria. He said further efforts are needed to alleviate the Syrian sufferings and help reconstruction there. Tahrir-Abouanchi said to reach those goals, all unilateral and coercive sanctions against Syria should be removed. Among other measures, he said those sanctions are only used for the collective punishment of the entire population in Syria. Tehran says the upcoming round of talks with the remaining signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal will be solely aimed at the removal of anti-Iran sanctions.
What is seriously important in the new round of talks is whether the other side is ready to make serious decisions on the removal of the illegal and cruel sanctions.
Malgari Kani, also serving as the chief Iranian negotiator in the talks, made the comment upon arrival in the Russian capital. He said he will discuss bilateral ties and the latest regional and international developments with Russian officials. The Iranian negotiator is in Moscow following his visit to the Belgian capital. In Brussels, he met with the coordinator of the Joint Commission of the Iran Nuclear Deal, Enrique Mora. Malgari Kani also has said that they agreed to begin discussion before the end of November. The exact date, however, will be announced next week. Iraq's Nujaba resistance movement has condemned the U.S. for its continued occupation of Iraq despite a nearing deadline to leave the country. The movement said the U.S. is acting against the will of the Iraqi people, arrogantly rejecting their demand for the withdrawal of American forces. And Nujaba said the U.S. is transferring some troops to Iraq using what the movement called old methods. And Nujaba added America is doing that despite the deadline set by the Iraqi government's calls for the U.S. pullout by the end of December. The deadline was set following an approval by the Iraqi parliament last year. The approval came after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi generals that led to popular calls for the American pullout. Now, Pakistan's foreign minister, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, says the United States' chaotic withdrawal and the fleeing of former Afghan officials set the breeding ground for terrorist groups like Daesh in Afghanistan.
That is exactly what we were saying. Pakistan was advocating consistently withdraw, but do it in an orderly fashion, you know, and that will help stabilize things in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the way Ashraf Ghani and his entire team, the way they capitulated and left, that created such a uncertainty that elements like such took advantage of. And you saw what happened at the airport, where innocent lives were affected. So, yes, that sudden withdrawal contributed to the confusion.
The top Pakistani diplomat was speaking with Press TV. He said terrorism is one of the main challenges facing Afghanistan today. But AC said Islamabad does not want to see Daesh footprint expanding in the region, adding a coordinated approach is needed to address the problem. International assistance, Qureshi said, can help prevent the economic collapse of Afghanistan. The Pakistani foreign minister told Press TV his country has not agreed to allow the U.S. to use its airspace for intelligence and military operations on Afghanistan. Regarding Iran, he said Tehran and Islamabad have recently increased their cooperation to stop terrorist attacks near their joint borders.
The spoilers within Afghanistan and beyond, who do not want to see stability in the region, right? They do not want to see stability within Afghanistan. So they always try to create misunderstandings. But fortunately, Pakistan, in the last 3 years since our government came into office, our bilateral relations with Iran have improved considerably. We have a mechanism in place now. We have structures in place through which we can coordinate, share intelligence.
Qureshi highlighted the importance of Islamabad's recent agreement on counter-terrorism with Tehran. He said the two sides have adopted a joint strategy to deal with terrorist attacks. A top Pakistani diplomat also said border violence has significantly declined in recent years. The two neighbors, he added, want to see a stable and peaceful region and are looking to expand their economic cooperation. Welcome to this hour's On the News Line. The war on Syria has had many different players, with Turkey and the U.S. remaining active on the battlefield. Yet they do not see eye to eye on one issue, and that is how to deal with the YPG Kurdish fighters. Turkey sees them as a threat, but the U.S. is backing them in their so-called fight against Daesh terrorists. Still, Washington and Ankara remain united on one issue. That is, Syria's democratically elected president, Bashar al-Assad, has to be ousted.
Turkey has dispatched truckloads of military and logistical equipment to northern Syria. Syrian media say that two convoys of 100 trucks each, carrying battle tanks, artillery batteries, and logistical supplies, cross into Syrian territories through Khirbet al-Jaz crossing. They reportedly headed towards Jabal al-Zawiya area in Syria's northwestern province of Idlib. Syria's official news agency, Sana'a, citing local sources, said that dozens of Turkish military trucks loaded with various ammunition and logistical supplies, as well as armored personnel carriers, entered Syrian territories. The convoy later headed toward positions held by Turkish-backed militants in the city of Ras al Ain. Turkey says the deployment is part of a plan to launch attacks on U.S.-backed Kurdish YPG forces. The deployment is also to fortify the position of Turkish military forces in northwest Syria and help Tekfiri militants fighting Syrian government troops. Idlib is the last major stronghold of foreign-backed terrorists. Most of them are members of the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham militant group. They are fighting against the legitimate government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So Turkey preparing or suggesting that it may launch yet again another invasion of Syria into what is sometimes referred to as Kurdistan against the YPG, the pro-U.S., anti-Assad militia groups that are comprised majority on the Syrian-Turkish border is going to put us into a political climate that is going to be tricky to figure out, to say the least.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019 after Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push fighters of the Kurdish People's Protection Units, YPG, away from the border areas.
Well, the destructive role that Turkey is playing in the war on Syria is being overshadowed by U.S. and Israeli actions. For one thing, the U.S. is occupying Syrian territory without a U.N. mandate, selling Syrian oil illegally. For another, Israel is striking the Syrian territory repeatedly, a sovereign nation attacked militarily, with the international community doing nothing to stop the airstrikes.
The deployment comes despite the opposition of Syrians to Turkey's military interventions. Turkey's parliament on Tuesday extended the military's mandate to launch cross-border operations in Syria and in Iraq by 2 more years. The motion was first approved in 2013 to support the campaign against the ISIL group, or Daesh terrorist, and has since been renewed annually. The motion could give President Recep Tayyip Erdogan a longer mandate to pursue campaigns against Kurdish militias in the rest of the region.
Well, quite frankly, it's an amazing racket. There's access to a whole lot of oil, and there's access to nearly unlimited oil fields in the region of Kurdistan. And so with the U.S. supporting the YPG and supporting these anti-Assad militias and in many cases terrorists, it gives the U.S. a foothold in two ways. It gives the U.S. a foothold economically, and it gives it a foothold socially.
Early this month, Turkish forces came under attack from a Kurdish militia group supported by Washington. Meanwhile, the U.S. will not be withdrawing its roughly 900 troops from northeast Syria anytime soon, despite mounting speculation that it would do so. U.S. forces were first dispatched to that region in 2014 under the former President Barack Obama.
The U.S. likes to portray the YPG and the fighters of Kurdistan as some sort of freedom movement, as some sort of liberation army, fighting for independence and sovereignty from the so-called oppressive regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Well, this couldn't be the farthest from the truth. The YPG, Kurdistan, is being played hand over fist by the U.S.
The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. But Damascus says the unlawful deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources.
And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Many of the Palestinian people displaced had sought refuge at facilities belonging to the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, which is the largest provider of aid in an area in which more than 70% of a population of some 2 million are refugees. But come summer, UNRWA chronically underfunded, despite the renewal of aids, wanted their buildings back to run summer camps for children. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hamza Abu El Tarabish, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Displaced by Israeli Regime Aggression, Family is angry at UN response. Stay tuned for more. At the beginning of July, Nasreen Al-Awar, 40, and her 15 children were informed they had to leave a school run by the UN in Jabalia refugee camp. Nasreen had been displaced during the Zionist regime's aggression on Gaza in May, when her house in Sudania area of northwestern Gaza suffered massive damage in one of the Israeli regime's bombing raids that month. There had been no possibility of reconstruction in the intervening period. The house remained as damaged as when she left it, and she was afraid to move back to a house that barely provided shelter for her husband, Ashraf, who is in poor health and had been chosen to stay in order to safeguard what was left of the family's home when it was bombed. But she was left with no choice. Today, she and Ashraf and their 15 children are sheltering in what remains of their home. Three walls are barely standing and the roof is full of holes. And Nasreen is angry and upset at the UN for letting her family down. "My house is unlivable," Nasreen told the electronic Intifaza, adding, "I am afraid the walls might fall on us suddenly." Some 91,000 people in Gaza were displaced during the May bombardment. Most have since returned to their homes, but in late June, for more than 8,000 people with homes totally or partially destroyed, that simply was not possible. Nasreen and her family would be safer in alternative housing than in the remnants of their home, but have no other recourse. And with the Zionist regime sealing Gaza's borders to most building materials, reconstruction of the 2,000 homes that were so damaged as to be uninhabitable has been effectively prevented. Many of the people displaced had sought refuge at facilities belonging to the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, which is the largest provider of aid in an area in which more than 70% of a population of some 2 million are refugees. But come summer, UNRWA, chronically underfunded despite the renewal of USAID, wanted the buildings back to run summer camps for children. Along with Nasreen's family, another 22 families were made to leave the school in Jabalia, while 8 families had to vacate their places at an UNRWA school in the Beach refugee camp. Some received help with rent, but only according to UNRWA if their homes had been completely destroyed in May. Most had to seek shelter with relatives or return to the shells of their old homes. Still, all this might have passed as just another hardship of the extraordinarily tough living conditions in the besieged Gaza Strip, had it not been for some extremely ill-judged remarks made by one of the UNRWA senior officials that described the Israeli regime's strikes in Gaza in May as sophisticated. "I have the impression there is a huge sophistication in the way the Israeli regime military struck over the 11 days. Matthias Campbell, UNRWA's director of operations in Gaza, told an Israeli TV channel on May 23rd, not long after the attack had ended. He acknowledged that more than 60 children were killed, 19 of whom went to UNRWA schools. But somehow, that suggested to him that the precision was there, even as he called the deaths of civilians unacceptable and unbearable. Unsurprisingly, his remarks went down extremely poorly, especially in Gaza. UNRWA cost-cutting measures and job reductions over the past few years, coinciding with Campbell's appointment, have come to be seen as an attempt at undermining the rights of Palestinian refugees generally." two human rights organizations, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and the Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council, issued a joint statement condemning his remarks, which they wrote completely ignored the crimes committed during the Israeli regime offensive. Angry voices online, both from Gaza and outside, denounced the UNRWA's director comments or called for his resignation, while protests were arranged in front of UNRWA's offices in Gaza that drew hundreds of people. UNRWA's director of operations in Gaza apologized for his comments, and the agency's commissioner general, Felipe Lazzarini, issued a written statement on this subject. But the damage was done. UNRWA recalled this person and his deputy to Al-Quds, where this person remains as acting chief of staff. Those remarks were the culmination of a series of missteps by Schemel that left both his personal credibility and that of UNRWA at a low ebb in Gaza. The director of UNRWA took up his position in 2017, a year before the Trump administration cut U.S. funding to the agency. His arrival, however, soon coincided with the slashing of UNRWA's budget. It became hugely unpopular when the agency revealed plans for hundreds of job reductions in 2018 following Trump's cruel cuts. Then UNRWA announced it would reform its food aid system, sparking fears that tens of thousands would sink deeper into poverty. And finally, the agency was woefully underprepared in May when it was suddenly faced with tens of thousands of people displaced by the Israeli regime's assault. Indeed, it was not only underprepared, for a while UNRWA staffers actively tried to prevent the desperate displaced from entering the agency premises. Nasreena and her children were among their number after surviving a close call. They had been expecting it. Every night of the last aggression, I would place my children in different corners of the house, Nasreen told the electronic intifada. But on evening of May 14th, after bombing intensified, we gathered in one room. We were 19 people, including my husband, daughter-in-law, and her child. I believe that if we die together, no one would have to suffer mourning the others, unquote. It was a wise decision. Heavy Israeli regime bombing in the area on the night between May 14th and May 15th caused the house to nearly collapse, but no one inside was harmed. And that was when they decided to leave for the relative safety of an UNRWA facility. At the Jabalia school, however, Nasreen found hundreds of other desperate people and the gates locked. Muhammad Awadullah, 33, was there too, fleeing with his wife and four daughters from an intense bombardment near their home in the village of Om Nasr in northern Gaza. He was not going to let some closed gates stop him from reaching relative safety. When they refused to receive us, we had no choice but to break the gate, he told the electronic intifada, adding, we have no choice but to protect our children. An UNRWA spokesperson considered that the agency had been unprepared and was not at first willing to host people displaced in the assault. There were instructions from management that no one was allowed access to schools, but we changed these decisions within the first hour of people's displacement, Adnan Abu Hasna told the electronic intifada. The escalation was sudden, and there had been no plan to receive displaced people. But UNRWA has always supported displaced people, unquote. Contingency plan or not, Nasreen now fears for her and her children's lives. Her house remains without secure walls or a full roof. And as the security situation in Gaza grows steadily worse, she worries about their safety. She has received no support from UNRWA, apart from some cans of fish, she told the electronic intifada. nothing has arrived to help her clothe her children or protect them through any kind of COVID-19 prevention. Today, the entire family shelters in just one room. It's a desperate situation with no end in sight. Abu Hasna conceded that not enough was done at the beginning, but he insisted agency had provided psychological support in part through the summer camps that saw people like Nasreen forced out of schools in July to tens of thousands of children across Gaza. UNRWA is also providing some financial assistance, he said. For thousands of people who remain displaced, such words ring hollow. The behavior of officials like Iskmal has left Palestinians in Gaza deeply suspicious of the agency and its motives.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akbay. Sudan's military has seized power in what is referred to as a coup. It has arrested members of the transitional government that was supposed to guide the country to democracy. What has prompted the military to seize power? And does this go against the people's will? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the transition did not take place as planned and whether there are foreign hands at play, like maybe from the UAE, Israel, or Saudi Arabia. Let's get an idea about what is happening there in Sudan. We have Ahmed Kabayo, our correspondent from London, who joins us to tell us more about this. Ahmed, welcome. So, you know, I know you're familiar with the landscape there in Sudan. If you can tell us what is going on, and briefly, just briefly, what was agreed upon before and where the disagreements came, and maybe to what it led to what happened today.
Yes, there was a power-sharing agreement, and there was a constitutional declaration that said there would be this share of power between the military and the civilian, transitional civilian government. And in that first 21 months, it was meant to be led by General Burhan, representing the military, but for the next 18 months, there was meant to be a transition where the civilian government led the Sovereign Council, which was the highest body in the land. Now, that 21 months was meant to end in November, so that's when the civilians were meant to take control of the Sovereign Council, and it seems that the military had no desire to hand over power. And this has been predictable, and some would say inevitable, because it was an uneasy relationship to begin with. This military sharing arrangement was only done as a compromise by the Sudanese people because they looked at the battle of forces on the ground and they realized the military were well equipped, well armed, and had support from some powerful neighbors, principally the United Arab Emirates, principally Saudi Arabia. And it wasn't a fight that peaceful protesters could win. So they agreed to this agreement, but many people warned them that the military were just buying their time and eventually they would do a coup d'etat. And today we woke up to the news to find out, today being that day, the Prime Minister has been arrested, the Minister of Information and the spokesman for the transitional government, someone that I interviewed exclusively for Press TV, he's been arrested and taken away to undisclosed location. And it seems like many more arrests are set to take place. There has been calls for civil disobedience, for general strikes, and they want to try and hurt the Sudanese economy because the people that control the Sudanese economy is the military junta, is the generals, is those associated with the army. And that's what brought about the stalemate in the first place that led to the power sharing agreement.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it for that roundup. Ahmed Kabayo there. All right, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe, joining us from Detroit. Also joining us is African Affairs analyst Lawrence Freeman, who joins us from Baltimore, Maryland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and I'm going to start first with you, if I may, Lawrence Freeman. We're looking at what has been referred to as a coup, and is this something that surprises you, and do you think that this so-called transitional government was not an easy merge between the civilian and the army, even though they had 18 months to try to sort things out, if there were disagreements between the two?
I was not surprised at all. In fact, I thought it could have happened sooner. I mean, the essential that when the Bush was removed, Sudan basically became a complete captive to the West, United States, British, Europe, to the International Monetary Fund, had to do what it was told in order to get so-called the debt freedom from its huge $50+ billion it owed our nation. And the problem was that prior to Bashir's overthrow, I spent 15 years trying to convince the government to build up the economy and integrate the South into an infrastructure network of the entire nation and raise the standard of living of people. They unfortunately had a tin ear and they were overthrown, but there was no compensating policy from the West. Sudan, like many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, needs energy, it needs water, it needs rail transportation. And the West, if they were serious, would have moved in massively building these structures. The people in Sudan, I've been there many times, are poor, and if you don't address the poverty, if you don't address the lack of economic future for these people, then there will be continued unrest. And with the Biden policy supporting regime change in Ethiopia against Prime Minister Abiy, and now this coup in Sudan, the Horn of Africa has become a very dangerous place and will affect the entire continent of Africa.
Okay, let's see what Abayomi Azikiwe thinks here. If we have Abayomi Azikiwe with us, doesn't look like we still have him with us. Okay, no, there he is. All right, very good. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Abayomi.
Yes, this is really not surprising considering the developments that have taken place over the last few weeks. We recall that about a week ago or so, there were demonstrations in the streets, ostensibly among people who were civilians who supported the continuation of military rule, and they wanted the dissolution of the Transitional Sovereign Council. And then on Thursday, the 21st, thousands upon thousands of people came out in Khartoum and in other cities across the country demanding an immediate civilian government. Of course, as has been mentioned before, the military controls a lot of the economic interests, the state-sponsored institutions, and also private institutions in Sudan. So they want to protect their interests, And it's going to be very interesting to see what the program is going to be, the policy of the United States towards these new developments. Mr. Feltman, who is an envoy for the Horn of Africa, visited Khartoum and met with the Foreign Affairs Minister just on Saturday, expressing concern about the problems that exist within the transitional regime. And, of course, here we are 2 days later. The military has taken over, yet there's unrest, apparently, throughout the country in response to this. The Army and the militia groups called the Rapid Response Forces, the General Burhan mentioned earlier that they were actually the ones behind this seizure of power, the arrest of the interim Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, as well as the Minister of Information, the Minister of Industry. And it appears that if some of the people who have been arrested are connected with Sudanese political parties, the Democratic Unionist Party and the Sudanese Congress Party. So it'll be interesting to see what the United States position is going to be on this, because they have been pushing very strongly for this government to solidarize.
Okay, lots of questions here. Let me see. Let me understand from you, Lawrence Freeman, why it is that, I think I asked this in my first question, but I'm not too sure, why the Military Council did not, was not able to agree with the civilian part of this equation. Because we had 2 years ago where Burhan said, quote, the role of the Military Council complements the uprising and the Blessed Revolution. And he said that the TMC was committed in handing over power to the people. And even back then, however, you had protesters that said the TMC was not serious about handing over power to civilians. Our correspondent just mentioned that also, that it was not serious from day one. So why did they enter this so-called power-sharing agreement here?
The TMC, like many of these operations in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, was an artificial, uneasy coalition that wasn't going to last. Because the fact of the matter is, once you overthrow Bashir and the National Congress Party, the only thing that was left that represented any kind of national institution was the military. And that's the way the British left much of their colonies over the period of colonialism. And therefore, and the only way this transition would have worked is if the United States and other Western nations had involved themselves in massive economic development for the people. Then the people could see something was getting done. That never happened. There was a small amount of debt alleviation. But people's lives, I've walked the streets of Khartoum and Omdurman and many parts of the country. Until you provide an improvement in the material standard of living, you will have demonstration after demonstration, and government after transitional government will continue to fall. And it's the West's stupidity on not realizing that this is the essential issue to provide stability. There was no stability in the TMC. There was no fundamental agreement, and regime change is never a solution in which they've been after Bashir for about 20 years to accomplish. We have to change our mindset. We have to change the way we think about Sudan and sub-Saharan Africa. And we have to involve the United States and the West in massive infrastructure, economic development to raise the standard of living of people. Until that is done, there will be no stability.
Okay, so we have about 7 or 8 minutes left. And I want to dedicate this to these foreign hands that are at play. So, Abiy Azikiwe, our guest there talks about how the U.S. failed in not providing the proper investment. It did promise it, though, and it's interesting that we have, and I'm going to bring in Israel in here, from an Israeli publication saying that Sudan was disappointed with the results of the so-called Abraham Accords, the so-called normalization of ties with Israel, and it said that there were failed economic promises by the U.S., that there was insufficient U.S. investment, and that was a complaint that Israel has said that the sources in Khartoum were talking about. What role does Israel play here? Is the U.S. investment in any shape or form connected to the so-called normalization of ties with Israel?
Clearly, it was connected. Under the Trump administration, He saw this as an achievement, a foreign policy achievement of his waning regime during 2020. Yet, despite this declaration of a, quote, normalization of relations, unquote, with the state of Israel, according to the foreign affairs minister, there has been no exchange of diplomats or other protocols between Tel Aviv and Khartoum. Also, the United States, in exchange for taking Sudan off the state sponsor of terrorism list, they had to commit themselves to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to survivors of those who were victims of terrorist attacks. And there was no specific or concrete evidence that the Sudanese government was responsible for the bombings that took place in 1998 in Tanzania and Kenya against the U.S. Embassy, or the USS Cole bombing in 2000. So these were all artificial barriers that were established, and they never delivered on any of the promises that were made. And at the same time, within Sudan itself, there are political parties and opposition groups who were totally against the normalization with Israel and other conditions that had been set by the United States, for example, to get IMF and World Bank loans. And we know over the last 40, 50 years what these economic measures have done to post-colonial Africa. They've only arrested development. They have not fostered genuine development and sovereignty. So you had several parties, including the Sudanese Communist Party and the Popular Congress Party and others, who opposed this supposed normalization of relations with Israel and other agreements that the U.S. arm-twisted Abdallah Hamdok into accepting. Now, they say he's been detained, along with other leading cabinet members. They say several people have been killed as a result of the military opening fire on people today. So the situation is very, very tense.
Okay, so let's, Lawrence Freeman, talk about money. Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they had agreed to send Sudan $3 billion. And back 2 years ago, they indicated that $750 million of that aid had actually been delivered. And $500 million was deposited in the central bank. Not bad to start out with. So you have that. And then you have the troika of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt, who supported this transition. Tell us the role that these three played, in particular the UAE and Saudi Arabia, when it comes to Sudan.
I think it's well known that even in the waning days of the Bashir administration, that the Saudis were bankrolling a good portion of the budget of Khartoum. And without the Saudis, the situation would have been even worse. But very little was done to actually improve the economy. As the previous speaker said, look, when Bashir was overthrown, and then the Trump administration said you have to then go ahead and recognize Israel as part of their Israel policy, that itself to me was clear as a bell that Sudan no longer was a nation. It no longer was a sovereign nation. It was a satrapy that was going to dance to the tune of the people who control the strings in Europe and the United States and the World Bank, etc. And therefore, Sudan gained nothing from that except being taken off the terrorist list and being given relief on some loans, but nothing was done to change the country. And the Egyptians are using Sudan against Ethiopia. Sudan gains completely, 110%, from the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. And the Egyptians have bludgeoned and manipulated Sudan into going against Ethiopia. So Egypt is playing a poor role. Saudi Arabia is not interested in the development of the nation, and neither is the West. And this is the sad story of sub-Saharan Africa, as I work in many countries in the region. And there will be another coup. There may be a coup within the coup, like we saw with Mali earlier this year. None of this will stop. None of this will abate. And you will not have, quote, stability until you actually have an improvement for the lives of the 50 million Sudanese people who live very, very poorly. And until the West understands that and stops attacking China for actually doing these kinds of investments, I do not see a hopeful future for Sudan, and I would suggest there will be other mass protest movements and more coups and destabilizations in Sudan, and potentially, as the Biden administration is promoting, possibly in dismemberment of Ethiopia. And then you would have hundreds of millions of destitute people in the Horn of Africa.
Indeed, that looks like a crisis that is erupting here. So we
yes.
are down to the one party that we have not talked about, Mr. Abiyomi Azikiwe, and that is the Sudanese people. Our guests there touched on it. What do they want? We know that they have gone out and protested against the so-called normalization of ties with Israel. But what is it that they want that they're not getting? I guess is the promise of this transition that didn't take place.
Yes, I believe the majority of the people there want a civilian government. They want to be able to operate politically and openly. And it's very interesting that General Al-Bahan, in his statement earlier today, said that he's carrying out a coup in order to continue the ideals of the December Revolution. I mean, this is absurd. I mean, the revolution was aborted by the military in April of 2019. In order to prevent a genuine popular revolution from taking place in Sudan. And then 2 months later, when people refused to leave the streets, there was a huge massacre. And the people responsible for that have never been brought to justice. And we could very well see another huge violation of human rights in the country as things are developing right now.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you very much. It was fascinating information here. We had Ahmed Caballo at the top of the spotlight, and you were just listening to Abiyomi Azikiwe from Detroit. Thank you, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, and Lawrence Freeman from Baltimore spoke to us, African Affairs analyst. And with that, we come to an end for
this edition
of the Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Do join us next time. For Mikabe Tafwe and the entire team, is goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. I am your humble, hopefully favorite host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have two brothers in faith and humanity. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, you guys. Would you do a brief introduction?
I'm Muzaffar Haider.
I'm Hassanain.
From the UK.
From India.
So today, first of all, thank you so much, you guys. So, Brother Hassanain, what's your definition of elites?
You know, elites, what I understand is, you know, the big, big political people, or the powerful people, you know, what today's world consider as, you know, the political figures, you know, the, as we call, like, the big shot people, big business tycoons.
So people with influence, you'd consider them as elites?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that those people who have a significant amount of influence. Because it's not necessarily those who you can see. Sometimes there are people behind the scenes, who are working. I'm not even talking about politics. There are people who in certain communities, for example, you know this uncle, you know that auntie, and they're actually the elites of the community.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know them, perhaps, but yeah.
A select group that is superior in terms of ability or qualities to the rest of a group or society, or a size of letter in typewriting. So, yeah, a group
Thank
of
you,
people.
Siri.
There is a group of people that are superior in their abilities and their qualities. And through that superiority, they have impact and influence on other people. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that definition is a little bit problematic because I think the context of our discussion is elites in society. I don't know.
Wait,
I kinda,
does it have
I kinda,
to do something with the wealth?
But sometimes you can say, like, this is a footballer, but this is an elite footballer, right? He's much, much better, right?
Yeah, of course, of course. You can always narrow it down, but then there's, like, general elite. People are just, like, elite in the world.
Would you consider yourself to be an elite, sister?
At home. For sure, I'm an elite at home. Or maybe in the extended family to a degree. But then it stops there because social
normally,
anxiety
normally, like in
happens.
General, the rich people are considered to be elites, right?
Definitely, because they've got influence. You know, rich people, we should not underestimate the influence of the rich folks.
Mm-hmm.
They influence the politicians. They influence the pharmaceuticals. They influence the media. You know, they influence a freaking pandemic.
Yeah.
So that they could be more rich.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back to Back to Reality after a short break, so don't go anywhere.
Azure dawning skies, I watch you bloom the birth of spring. You are the song that all lovers sing. You are the key holding me in.
Thank you so very much for joining us again on this show. This is Back to Reality. I'm in the studio with my special guests. How about elites in a religious context?
What is the term for elites in the Quran, man? I don't know why it's slipping my mind for the last 2 days.
Abrar? As-sabiqun?
No. In the negative context where they denied the elites of Noor society when the Anbiya came to them. Hold on.
Al-Mala?